They say England is a land where the past never quite lets go, where echoes of the dead still linger in centuries-old manors, mist-covered moors, and crumbling ruins. Tonight, we welcome a man who doesn't just write about these haunted places. He's walked their halls, chronicled their legends, and even faced their ghosts. John West is the resident ghost expert for Psychic News, the world's longest-running paranormal publication. He's the author of Britain's Haunted Land, a seasoned filmmaker, and a voice behind a chilling new documentary on Bram Stoker, the father of Dracula himself. But what about poltergeists? They're not your typical ghost story. These are violent, chaotic, and often terrifying forces that don't just go bump in the night. They smash, scratch, throw, and torment. Tonight, John West, the UK's resident ghost expert and longtime contributor to Psychic News magazine, is here to explore the latest chilling work, Poltergeists, a Casebook of Destructive Hauntings. I'm Dave Schrader, and this is Paranormal 360. Joining me now on the John Schuster Coldwell Banker Hotline, John West. John, thank you so much for being here this evening.
Oh, it's wonderful. And what a brilliant introduction. That's the best I've ever read. Thank you very much.
Well, you know, when I've got a brilliant guest that's got all of this background and accolades, I've got to make sure we mention him. What a fascinating world. I've been to England a handful of times now. I've had a chance to go through some of your old castles and crypts. I've had a chance to experience some of the legends and lore, and it's remarkable. I love the respect that you have for the spirit realm over there, the acceptance. It's not like a weird taboo. It doesn't seem like there has been in America for such a long time. Has it always been so readily embraced in the UK, or is this something that really over the last 20, 30 years has become more comfortable to talk about and be open about?
Oh, no, in Britain, people have always loved ghost stories. It goes back centuries. There was a chap in the 12th century was writing about them, and there's cases way before that as well. I think it could be to do with the Celtic strain in our population, because the Celts were supposed to be very spiritual and more in touch with the psychic side, shall we say, for instance, the Scots with a second sight. So no, it's certainly not something that started in the last 20, 30 years. The English have always loved ghosts, literally for centuries.
Right, but the concept of it not being as taboo a subject, I noticed in the United States over the last 20 years, it's become much, you know, it's water cooler talk. People can discuss it openly. There's not that same raised eyebrow and roll of the eyes and kind of huffing and snorting. They cover it on the news a lot now. There's ghostly encounters, UFO encounters, strange cryptid beasts on the news, and they're taking it a lot more seriously. So I just wondered if that was something that has always been kind of accepted even by your media.
It's been phases in Britain. I mean, the media has always been fascinated with ghosts. And for instance, in the Victorian period with spiritualism, it was always being covered in the newspapers. And generally, the TV and radio love it as well. I mean, occasionally I was on shows where they suddenly decided they didn't want to really talk about ghosts. But on the whole, it's always been a very open society regarding the afterlife and the paranormal, unless you're a sort of member of a particular religious sect or something where it's all the work of the devil. But yeah, generally we're quite open about it and always have been, and open to discussing it.
Now, I want to discuss poltergeist with you. Obviously, this is something that's, you know, grabbed the attention of the world, especially since the very famous poltergeist movie serials, right? That just really seemed to capture a new interest in that type of haunting. But it seems people I speak to that, you know, that work in this field and write about it, research it, all have a unique perspective on poltergeist itself. What is John West's thoughts on what a poltergeist is? Is it a being? Is it multiple beings? Is it nothing to do with ghosts, but more to do with psychokinetic energy? Is it just getting too drunk at the pub? I don't know. What's your take on this, John?
Oh, that's a very difficult question, and I cover it in the book version, which will be coming out later this year. There's different explanations. My own personal view would be that it's possibly some sort of spirit, at least an entity that's latched on to a particular individual, or it might even be more than one individual, and it uses their energy to manifest itself. That's my take on it. Other people believe it's literally just, you know, the power of the mind, you know, the psychic ability of an adolescent. But yeah, I would say it's some sort of entity, a spirit that's using a person to manifest itself.
It seemed interesting to me that there are some people who just want to pigeonhole it. This is what it is, right? It is a prepubescent teen, boy or girl, or now we're finding out maybe even menopausal woman. And it's definitely like during these fluctuations, these erratic, I have to be careful, I almost said erotic, but erratic changes in our physical chemistry that might be unleashing these energies. But it could be not so much a chicken or the egg thing, but more along the lines of that it all comes together at one point. Somebody that is acting as a battery feeds the supernatural force around them to create more of this chaos, which also then causes distress and anxiety on them, which unleashes more PK-like activity. So it could be one giant vicious circle and cycle of activity that's taking place.
Yes, definitely. I'd agree with that. The majority of poltergeist cases are associated with, shall we say, unhappy homes. There could be an absent parent. There could be poverty, depression. They're not always associated, as you pointed out, with adolescence. There's been even cases of women in their 70s, men, women in their 30s, menopausal women. So it used to be thought at one point, oh, it's just teenage girls. But now we find with the evidence that's not the case. It's more 50-50, shall we say. Females and males can have these things attached to them. But there's also interesting cases that don't fit that pattern. For instance, there's a place called Dagworth Hall in Suffolk, which had poltergeist activity going back centuries. And even now, apparently, well, until recent times, there's poltergeist activity in that hall. So that suggests that some poltergeists are location-based, because obviously it couldn't be attached to someone for 700 years because you don't live that long. So it's, you can't pigeonhole this this particular subject. You know, there's so many different things that don't always fit in with the accepted view of poltergeists. So I'm very open-minded on the subject.
What encapsulates the activity that makes them call it a poltergeist as opposed to just a ghost?
Well, there's actually several stages of a poltergeist haunting, if you want to call it a haunting. And it can start off with at the beginning, sort of scratches, and people assume it's, or rats, and they assume it's mice or sort of some sort of rodent in the skirting board, shall we say. Then it starts to increase. The second stage, like sort of footsteps, knocks, bangs, even sounds that have been likened to like an explosion. Then you've got the third stage where objects start to be moved. Stones can be thrown and sometimes appear out of nowhere. Then furniture starts to be smashed. It's basically a gradual increase. And then the entity will try to communicate, usually through rats. Then there'll be barks and sort of guttural noises if it's trying to learn how to speak. Then it'll speak through someone. Can be very violent, can be playful, can use abusive language. And then eventually even fires can break out as well, so it can cause that. And then it sort of winds down and becomes less and less, and then goes. Again, there's some cases where poltergeists are still there, as I said, with this Dagworth case in Suffolk. But that generally is the consensus. There's several stages. It starts off softly, gets really intense, and then fades away, and then the poltergeist goes.
Interesting, because what you just described also sounds like infestation, oppression, which leads to possession, the demonic case. We'll talk a little bit more with our guest, John West, about that when we return. You are tuned in to the very best in paranormal talk radio. I'm Dave Schrader. This is the Paranormal 360. All right, John West, our guest this evening, and John is talking to us about poltergeist. This is a fascinating subject to me, and you were talking about how these things slowly begin to amp up, maybe from scratching noises in the wall to becoming something more aggressive to, you know, violently shaking furniture, smashing furniture. It does seem to amp up as we begin to amp up, as our fear begins to elevate and escalate. So does this energy, which to me sounds like that becomes more of the PK, because as your anxiety gets more unbridled and you're having more of these issues, you're unleashing this fear and it's interacting and reacting or playing with you. What you described, if I flipped it on the other side and talked about infestation and oppression and then possession, is what, you know, people that are working in the field of exorcism would talk about. How do we differentiate it between poltergeist activity and demonic activity?
Yeah, that is very hard to sort of, you know, sort of discuss that sort of situation without sort of getting sort of, I don't know, it's an interesting one. I don't subscribe to the sort of demonic thing. I think that there's too many, shall we say, paranormal shows that sort of automatically everything's demonic. So I don't think it is demonic. I don't think, I know there's similarities there. Definitely, but I would say that literally it's some sort of entity. I don't believe it's of the devil. Although centuries ago, they did believe poltergeists were caused by the devil or even the devil himself. There's cases where they said that the devil appeared or a poltergeist would claim to be the devil. The thing is that poltergeists often claim to be what we want them to be, whether it's a deceased loved one, the devil or something else. So I would even call them like tricksters. They're out to fool us, but I'm very skeptical. And with all due respect for people who believe it is demonic, I'm very skeptical of that angle. I don't personally believe that it is the case, but you know, I am open-minded, but you know, I've yet to be persuaded, shall we say.
Just remember, John, they say that the best trick the devil ever played on us was to make us believe he didn't exist.
Well, you've got a point there. You've got a point. As I said, there were poltergeists claimed to be the devil, but who knows? But yes, I'll bear that in mind, definitely.
Do you think that some of these energies are not necessarily even spiritual in nature, that they're not in the way that we can, you know, perceive it to be? John passes away, his ghost steps out of his body, is now haunting and maybe is upset and doesn't like people changing the atmosphere around his home, so he starts acting out. Could it be more of a manifestation of many energies? You know, there's so many battlefields throughout Europe and America where it is a psychic or cyclical scar that's there, that it's not just representative of one ghost, but maybe the pain of multiple ghosts, an entity that is bearing slices and slivers of many personalities as opposed to just one thing.
Well, there is a theory about that, and it's sort of linked to the stone tape theory that intense emotions can be imprinted into the fabric of a building or even the soil and are played back, or someone can pick them up. So, yeah, that is a good theory. Again, the problem with poltergeists is there's so many theories that, you know, I mean, for instance, there's another one that they're elementals. They're actually entities that never existed in a living human form, that there's even thought forms that have been created. There's that theory that you, in intense emotion, perhaps if you're thinking about a phantom monk and you've got the power, you can literally create that phantom monk and it takes on a life of its own. There's also a theory that poltergeists are from another dimension and they've somehow found themselves in our dimension and can't get back and panic and then cause all this trouble. But yeah, I think poltergeists, whatever they are, they do latch onto energy. They could even be linked to ley lines. There's another theory that they appear where they intersect and they're drawing that energy from the earth. Even water has been brought into it. Sometimes they find pools of water and there was a theory that they're drawing energy from water. So who knows? I mean, there was one poltergeist case, Pontefract, where there was apparently a well below the floor and they felt that was connected with it. That was a phantom monk, funny enough.
Right. Well, let's discuss that. What are some of the stories, these poltergeist claims that you feel legitimately hold water?
Well, the Enfield poltergeist is possibly the most famous. I've actually got a strong connection to that because I lived in Enfield at the time. Enfield is in North London, by the way, and it was in Green Street. And my mum actually used to walk down Green Street to get her hair done. And she spoke to a lollipop lady who actually was standing outside the house and saw the girl at the center of the poltergeist activity levitating by the window, floating up and down. It started in 1977. It was a family called the Hodgsons. Peggy Hodgson was the mother. The father wasn't there, which, again, is you find this in many cases. It was an unhappy home. It was a poor home. The two girls were entering puberty. The poltergeist seemed to center on one particular girl called Margaret. And again, it started off with sort of minor things, the movement of furniture, knocks, bangs. The press got involved. They contacted the SPR, Society for Psychical Research, and they sent a chap called Morris Gross, who was very famous in Britain. He sadly passed away, but he investigated his case. And he brought in a chap called Guy Playfair, who actually did a book on the Enfield haunting called This House is Haunted. And it followed the stages of the poltergeist. And it was started off gradual. It increased. There were knocks, bangs, apports, things appearing, disappearing. Then it started to speak through Janet, and it could speak for hours. And it seemed to be using a false vocal cord. Now, I've done a bit of acting, and you can do this, but you can't do it for hours at a time because it would literally wreck your voice, permanently damage your vocal cords. But she could do this for hours. But anyway, they investigated it. They were convinced it was genuine. The activity was witnessed by other people. There were apparitions seen as well. Other members of the SPR dismissed it and said that it was all trickery and Janet was faking it. And she did admit to faking some of it at the end, but that was when the activity was decreasing and she wanted to keep... You know, she was a young girl. She was a centre of attention and she loved it. So I'm not surprised that she did. But then it...
Well, right. You watch those clips, and there's a lot out there about the case, right? I've often thought that it was kind of unfair for them to put that on a kid, because now her reputation, her family's reputation are all on the line. And at one point, Enfield was a revolving door of celebrity, right? People were coming in and out of that house constantly to witness this. And then you come in the house and nothing's taking place. So does Janet maybe make something happen so that they don't seem like fakes and frauds, using the logic of a child? You know, that's a lot of pressure to put on a family that doesn't want to be looked at as nuts or hoaxers.
Oh, definitely. And Janet admitted in adult life that, you know, she got bullied at school. They called her the ghost girl and hit her and things like that. And you've hit the nail on the head. Yeah, she wanted to, you know, make these things happen. I mean, you had the Warrens visited at Enfield. It later became The Conjuring 2 film, a highly fictionalized account of the haunting. But they went there. So, yeah, you had all these people coming in, and she was expected to perform. So it was tremendous pressure on the girl. And like I said, she wasn't happy. She was from a home where dad wasn't there. He had no money and, you know, the usual things that teenage girls were going through. So, yeah, I felt sorry for her, actually. I mean, as a kid, you didn't think of these things. I used to talk about it in the playground. Oh, did you hear about the ghost girl? And my mum went down there and spoke to the lollipop lady and saw her levitating. But yeah, when you're as an adult, you think, God, you know, she really went through it. I do say that Morris and Guy did treat her fairly, but she was the centre of a circus, and it did affect her. For years, she wouldn't talk about it. I'm not surprised.
Well, Guy Lion Playfair, at least the name lives up to the action, right? We have to take a quick break. I want to talk about the dysfunctionality aspect of this, because we hear that in so many of these cases, especially when it's centered around poltergeist-like activity. However, if that's the case, when has there ever been a more dysfunctional time than right now? John West, our guest here. I'm Dave Schrader. This is the Paranormal 360, your home for all things supernatural, every Sunday night, 7 to 9 p.m. Central. And John, talking about the dysfunctionality of some of these cases, it's real easy to say, well, you know, usually we find that it's from broken homes, or there's alcoholism, or maybe even drug abuse, which, even looking at cases like the Amityville Horror, since the time has come out, the two sons from Amityville have both said that George Lutz was doing drugs and drinking, and it was also in a transcendental meditation. So he was calling things in. Every one of these cases can say that there's some form of dysfunctionality, but in 2025, right, in the 21st century, the first quarter of that century, what isn't dysfunctional? What family isn't dealing with some kind of strife? Why isn't the world shaking apart from poltergeist activity if that's the case?
Well, that's a good question, and a very hard one to answer, because, yes, I mean, literally every family should have a poltergeist, but obviously they don't. These things just seem to latch on to particular individuals or families. And again, we can't really explain why, apart from the things we've already gone through. I know, interestingly, a friend of mine, chairman of the Ghost Club, Alan Murdy, was involved in the making of the documentary. He found a link that possibly poltergeists can also be connected to people who've got cancer. Sometimes there's people with cancer in the whole household, and it seems to latch on to them. Again, this is another theory that's added to the mix. And
well, I know Dr. Thelma Moss from UCLA, when she was part of the paranormal deal there, and Dr. Barry Taff have talked about epilepsy seems to be key in a lot of people that are dealing with poltergeist activity as well.
That is correct. In fact, Colin Wilson, in his book Poltergeist, which everyone should read, it's one of the best accounts of it, talked about the split brain, that we've got a left and right, and it's almost like we've got two people inside our heads. And yes, it is linked to that sort of thing as well. The problem, as I said, with poltergeist phenomena is there's so many different explanations for it, and I don't think there is literally just one that we can say, yes, that's what's causing it. I think it's different things, different mixes, shall we say. But why we haven't all got a poltergeist, I wouldn't like to say, but perhaps there's not enough of them to go around. If they are literally spirits, physical entities, perhaps they just want to latch on to particular households that are really bad and the energy is really bad, so they can manifest themselves more. Because, you know, every married couple has rows and that, but then it calms down and everything's hunky-dory again, shall we say. And a poltergeist probably wouldn't be able to do anything. But, you know, if you've got a family where there's constant tension, perhaps even some sort of abuse, physical or otherwise, then that's an ideal breeding ground for these things, whatever they may be.
All right. We talked about the Enfield poltergeist. You briefly touched on the Pontefract poltergeist. What are a few other cases that you feel really, really hit home and seem to be a legitimate claim to this type of phenomena?
Well, the Epworth poltergeist in Lincolnshire is a classic case. It was the home of John Wesley, the founder of Methodism. Although he was away at the time, he was at school. And this was in the 18th century. And it only happened for a couple of months. I think it was 1716 or 1717. But basically, again, the classic things started to happen. It was gradual. There'd be a knock at the door. A servant went there. There was no one there. They'd hear raps, bangs, sound of a silk dress, footsteps. Weirdly, the sound of money being poured onto the floor. They saw a headless badger, a couple of the inhabitants. Seemed to be centred around a girl called Hetty, who was, shall we say, sort of quite sexual. So it seemed to latch on her. She was the centre of it. But that went on for a couple of months, as I said, and then it sort of faded out. But there was a lot of tension in the family. The father had left home for a year because he fell out with his wife over politics. He supported the old pretender and she supported the new king. So, you know, the Jacobites and the Georgians.
Right.
And so basically that for me was a classic one, and it's never been disproved. There were allegations that some people in the village didn't like him because the father was Samuel Wesley was very opinionated. It was his way or no way. So the villagers didn't really like him. And he'd also spoken out against people in the village. But I think it was a genuine case because, you know, so many things happened that would have been impossible to replicate. So that's a classic one for me, the Epworth poltergeist in Lincolnshire. And Wesley actually wrote an account of it as well, which I believe is online, which makes a fascinating read. But I definitely think it was centered around Hetty and it was to do with her sexual awakening. Especially as this new servant had joined, and apparently he was quite attractive. So, and there was several girls in the household as well. So there was all that sort of tension building up, and obviously with a domineering father.
If Hetty was sexually awakening, it might explain the bangings on the wall at night, but I don't know that necessarily had anything to do with ghosts, John.
it could have been. I didn't think of that. I'm very naive in that respect then, but
I don't think I've thought of it.
could have been, but other people, they even heard taps. One of the girls tapped on the floor, and the tapping repeated itself from literally under her feet. And obviously this headless badger was seen, a white rabbit as well, nothing to do with Alice in Wonderland. But yeah, so I think it was genuine, although obviously some people might say it was a load of rubbish and it was all Hetty getting up to no good and blaming a poltergeist, but who knows.
Well, you know, the big question remains in the paranormal field. Are we in danger with a haunting? Can a ghost really hurt us? I would guess more in a poltergeist activity, you would be more in danger. Things fly around the room. In the Enfield poltergeist case, toys would be flung at people. Things would fly off the shelves, right? So we do know that. Have we got any cases where it's truly destructive, where it was hurting and injuring the living within these homes or within these structures?
There's several cases, actually. There was sadly one in Brazil, a girl called Maria that was attacked. It started off really friendly and playful and used to give her gifts. Then it got violent and attacked her. and really attacked her, you know, caused physical harm. And tragically, later on, she committed suicide. The Bell Witch from Tennessee, early 19th century, that attacked inhabitants of the house, particularly the father of a girl who it sort of was centered on. It claimed to have poisoned him, but it literally tried to throttle him. There's other cases, one in Bristol, where they reported that the poltergeist tried to strangle a girl. So on the whole, they tend to be playful and not that aggressive, but there have been cases where they've bitten, slapped, attacked, scratched, and even tried to strangle. And in the Bell Witch case, if the poltergeist was telling the truth, it killed the father, the girl it was obsessed with.
Now, here's where it gets interesting, to me at least, is again, we look at the through thread through many of the different calls and claims of the paranormal. And in a lot of ways, things start off very basic and innocuous, right? There's nothing inherently threatening. What you just told me reminds me of a lot of stories of people that are encountering Bigfoot. Sometimes they'll leave treats out, an apple or, you know, a pretty rock or something. And then they start, you know, maybe falling a little short on doing that all the time. And then it starts to anger the Bigfoot and things start to amp up and it turns and becomes violent in nature. It's an interesting element, right? You wouldn't put one and one together to come up with two in this sense. But when you start to look at it, same with aliens, there are people that have had great encounters or, like in the case of Whitley Strieber, terrifying encounters that over time become more friendly. So there is this kind of strange switch that takes place in some of these elements of claims like this. We have to take our final break and we'll come back with more John West, more about the destructive nature of poltergeist cases. And has our guest ever witnessed something himself? Has he ever seen an unleashed poltergeist? And if so, what is that like? We'll discuss that when we return right here. All right, John, you heard the question before the commercial break. Have you ever had an encounter with something you believe to be true? Actual poltergeist?
Well, I've had an encounter with what I term possibly a ghost, but it could have been a poltergeist. I lived in Mundham in Suffolk in a property which dated back to the 17th century, or part of it was Victorian, and on two occasions in the night I had the duvet pulled off me, and I hastened to add there was no one else with me, and that wasn't pleasant. But that started off when I first moved there. It was quite active. I'd hear knocks and bangs. Things would be moved. A girlfriend of mine at the time smelled perfume, lavender perfume, and toast as well in the living room. But yeah, the duvet being pulled off twice in the night was quite scary. And I did actually say, you know, I know I've got to share this place with you, but you'd never do that again. And it didn't. But a film director I work with, Jason Figgis, who's actually directing the Poltergeist documentary, he stayed with me. We were doing a film, I think it was A Ghost of Winifred Meeks, as I was in it as an actor. He slept on the living room floor, and I lent him a duvet, and it did the same to him, but it grabbed his foot. It was supposed to be a female, so perhaps she preferred him to me, I don't know. But I don't think that was a poltergeist, so I've never actually experienced a full-on poltergeist personally, and I've spoken to people that have. So I suppose I'm quite glad, really, is I don't really want stones being thrown around the room or things being chucked at me or being scratched or strangled. It wouldn't be very pleasant at all. Like I said, I don't want stuff being thrown around tonight in my room.
Let's discuss a little bit of that aspect as well. Sometimes it's the perceptions that people have. It's their expectations that seem to open them up to this type of activity. I've been around people who are so fearful. They've watched all the horror movies and now they're terrified of every noise they hear. And they're certain that they're being targeted. And then things start to amp up in their lives. I've had the great pleasure and honor to talk to some of these people and help them de-escalate a little bit, help them regain control of that fear factor, give them another way to, you know, have insight into what might be taking place. And sometimes when they embrace that, the scariness goes away. Once they've embraced the element of, you know, it's not necessarily a demon, it's not necessarily something trying to hurt you, it's just trying to get your attention. Once you've given it the attention, the acknowledgement, a lot of times these spirits or energies will dissipate.
Yeah, exactly. I'd agree with that. And let's face it, fear is energy, and they could be latching onto that. I've known people who've used Ouija boards and have allowed something into their home. And it seems that the more scared they become, the greater the activity. But then, as you've pointed out, when you sort of teach these people not to be scared, the entity's got nothing nothing to feed off, and it goes away. And again, not all of these things are, you know, not all ghosts are harmful. And with poltergeists, obviously, you know, if they are some sort of lower spirit, it's just like playful, shall we say, or perhaps nasty adolescents who just want to cause mayhem and then move on to the next person, or just literally fade away after a time and are never seen or heard of again.
John, there is a new wave that's being explored in science that things that we consider inanimate objects may actually have a form of consciousness. What are your thoughts that these houses aren't haunted by John or Dave's ghost? They're haunted by the memories of that house, the life that we breathe into it, that it becomes its own living entity. And sometimes when you are destructive or dysfunctional, it's lashing out because it doesn't want that. The house itself is what's lashing out.
That's a very good theory and a very good point. And I've spoken to quite a few people that have been in properties, and I've been in properties myself, where you instantly feel as if you're not welcome. And as you said, all the emotions over perhaps centuries, I mean, the place I lived in, you know, 17th century, all the things that happened there, the people that died there, the people that loved their children, that's all imprinted into the fabric of a building. So, I mean, I was in a church once and the atmosphere was so bad, I had to leave. That's the only church I've ever been in where I felt that. And then I found out other people had experienced this. This was in a church in Suffolk. I better not name it. I don't want to upset the vicar. Yeah, I believe that there's a strong possibility that's the case, that these houses, these buildings do become, shall we say, living in some respect, and they don't like what's going on. These feelings and sensations, I believe, are imprinted into the fabric of a building. As I said, the stone tape theory, and it's played back from time to time if you're sensitive to it. Or even the atmosphere, or its electrical disturbance, can sometimes increase this stuff as well.
Something to think about, right? I mean, here's the fact that, like Carillion photography, we can take a leaf and photograph that leaf through Carillion photography, then remove a piece of the leaf and take another photograph, and you will see the physical representation of the leaf, but you'll also see an energetic representation of the piece that's missing. So we hear about people bought this house, they start renovating it, and all hell breaks loose. I've thought, man, I wonder if it has nothing to do with the human element, but it's the house. You're altering its bones and structures. That would be like us getting a parasite within us. Something enters us, something begins to change us, and we violently react, right, through vomiting or other physical manifestations. It's just something that I've always thought very curious, that maybe there is more to the house itself being alive or having some form of consciousness to it.
Oh, definitely. As I said, you know, if you can walk into a house and it feels friendly or it feels hostile, and So I would agree with that 100%. I mean, for instance, even the energy, the Jack the Ripper murders, certain murder sites, animals would not go near the where the bodies have been found for perhaps years, decades afterwards. So what were they picking up? The negative energy of what Jack the Ripper did? So, yeah, I believe that, you know, possibly buildings are, you know, can take on a living aspect, especially the older they are. I mean, some places that witness terrible things, people have gone there and have had to, you know, like castles where there were dungeons and people were tortured, they've had to leave because of the atmosphere is so oppressive. And I've read and experienced, you know, spoken to people who've been in properties that the properties clearly did not want them there and they were forced to move out. And then you find out that every few months a tenant was there and then had left because they just couldn't stay. So, yeah. Is the property basically didn't want anyone living there. It just wanted everyone out.
I love these kind of topics. I love being able to expand the concept of what we're dealing with or maybe dealing with, that it's not so easy to compartmentalize these type of hauntings. And we need to stay fluid. We need to stay aware and awake. We have about 30 seconds left. John, what do you want to tell people about the book, about the documentary, and what they can look forward to with your research?
Right. Well, we cover a comprehensive history of poltergeist hauntings and we give the various possible explanations. I don't come to a conclusion because it would be unfair of me to do that. It will be directed by Jason Figgis. Alan Murdy gave me a lot of research, chairman of the Ghost Club, and he also writes for 14 Times. It'll be made this year and it will be available on streaming. Whether it will come out on the Blu-ray or DVD, I don't know. Hopefully it might be shown on TV. So there you go. And the book version will be coming out hopefully this year. It will have extra material in it. And Alan Murdy has done a lovely afterword for me. And also the introduction is by Damon Wilson, the son of Colin Wilson.
Fantastic. Well, let us know as all of these things come to fruition. From a frog-draped countryside to the cobbled lanes of the haunted towns. John West guided us through a chilling history where the past refuses to stay buried. His stories, research, and personal encounters prove that Britain's haunted legacy isn't just folklore. It's still very much alive. Thanks to John for helping us walk with ghosts tonight, right here on the Paranormal 360.